This podcast is a production of KCRW.com.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, and prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, the William Morris Mailroom is the high-stress, low-pay sanctum sanctorum of showbiz. It can lead straight to the top or leave you in a straitjacket. We'll have part two of our conversation with ex-assistant Josh Steinberg. Plus, writers usually fight to get credit. So what does it mean when a writer takes his name off a film? But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. From the show that we sometimes wish we could take our name off of, it's The Business from NPR. NBC already streams many of its popular shows online. And now, with a new initiative they call NBC Direct, consumers will be able to download free of charge shows like Heroes, The Office, and The Tonight Show on the night they're broadcast, and keep them for 7 days. The downloaded files would degrade after a 7-day period and become unwatchable. Except, of course, for Donald Trump's The Apprentice, which is unwatchable right from the start. NBC Universal Television Group President Jeff Gaspin told The New York Times the file self-destruction is, quote, kind of like Mission Impossible, only I don't think there would be any explosion or smoke. So while NBC announced they'll start giving it all away in a few weeks, it seems like ABC will beat them to the punch when they start putting their shows up for free on AOL, effective immediately. They'll also make them available through their online joint venture with Fox, called Hulu, sometime in October. Speaking of online delivery, back at the Hollywood bargaining table, writers and producers resumed glaring at each other. Negotiating. Last week. At issue is how writers should be compensated when networks distribute stuff they've written online. How's it going, exactly? Well, Nick Counter, the chief negotiator for the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, offered this statement last week. Quote, the Writers Guild of America made clear that they are not serious about negotiating a new contract and have a total disregard for the true state of the industry and its fundamental economics. End quote. Ironically, some TV writers and producers seem to be adapting to the new paradigm rather adroitly. For example, 2 weeks ago, Ed Zwick and Marshall Herskovitz took back a pilot from ABC, which the network had tried to change in ways they found bedeviling, and they then set up the show, called Quarter Life, at MySpace. MySpace won't pay for the shows, which cost $80,000 an episode, but Zwick and Herskovitz are betting that selling advertising will be enough to make back their investment, which, by the way, is the highest cost per show yet on the web. And we're betting on Zwick and Herskovitz. They've won or been nominated for something like 11 Emmys and Oscars between them. Finally, in a shocking disruption of Hollywood's chi, William Morris sent its employees all over the city to perform volunteer activities last week. Yes, agents and assistants helped out at 15 organizations, including Habitat for Humanity, Tree People LA, Project Angel Food, and the Westside Children's Center. Initially, many top agents tried to get out of volunteering, but then the agency made it clear that subbing for a client in a 12-step meeting didn't count. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up later in the show, a writer writes himself out of the credits. But next, the talent agency email that had Tinseltown tongues a-flapping. Part 2. Josh Shy Steinberger had been an assistant at William Morris for 2 years when he decided to leave the agency to pursue his career as a writer and a comedian. He sent a good-natured, if barbed, goodbye email to his friends and colleagues at the agency. Some thought the missive, entitled I Love You, WMA, broke some kind of assistant's code of silence, and it caused quite a stir as it made the rounds in and out of the agency and finally into the press. Here's Shy himself reading a bit of that email.
There are a lot of things I'm going to miss about this place. I will miss mistaking Molly Sims for a new assistant and urging her to come quickly to the atrium for free kookaroo on a Thursday night. I will miss whooping and hollering at the top of my lungs for John Travolta in the 151 lobby. I will miss trying unsuccessfully to get lucky with a gorgeous summer intern in the legal files closet of the 150 building. And I will miss sexual harassment training, which has been enormously educational for me. I will miss introducing myself to Jim Wyatt at the 2005 WMA Christmas party, and Jim responding that he recalled seeing me unshaven on October 16th of that year.
You don't need to know that Jim Wyatt is the head of William Morris to get a sense that this letter is an unusual peek inside a rarefied and secretive culture. Last week, we aired part one of our conversation with Shai about life inside a talent agency. He talked about his previous job at the great and powerful Creative Artists Agency, which he quit after being verbally abused by his boss. After licking his wounds for a few months in his childhood home of Teaneck, New Jersey, he returned to Hollywood. To his surprise, he says he was actually greeted with open arms by the various studios and agencies where he interviewed. He ended up in the mailroom of the venerable William Morris Agency. You know, not many people understand the unique perspective that talent agency assistants have on the business. The point is to sort of train you as a Jedi inside the agency from the ground up, right?
Literally, from the first day when I put my hands on the mail cart, I was like really excited. I was like, listen, it's like if this is where Geffen and Ovitz and Barry Diller started, and it's good enough for me, you know. And there's a method to the madness because you meet everybody if you're pushing the cart around because you have to drop off every single person's mail in the whole building and take it in. There's always an opportunity if you know you're aware and you're alert. There's always going to be an opportunity to win some agent over, introduce yourself. You have to be careful. It's a good time because you don't want to like, you know, be over eager and barge into someone's office, you know, while they're in the middle of closing a deal, and then, you know, then you're annoying and rude and, you know, overeager. But there's always an opportunity, and I met everybody when I was pushing the mail cart. I introduced myself to Jim Wyatt in the hallway. I introduced myself to Dave Wirtschafter.
Wyatt and Dave Wirtschafter, of course, are the CEO and president of William Morris.
And they were awesome. I mean, from the moment I started William Morris, it was just a really good vibe, really friendly. I think that, you know, the kind of stuff that I dealt with at CIA didn't seem like it was going to happen again. I think people just seem to be a little nicer.
I want to ask you, you know, you're in this building now, in this, and, you know, running around with your mail cart with JDs and MBAs. I mean, these are all people who've had great success. In some cases, are making six-figure salaries. All of a sudden, they're pushing a mail cart. How does that work? What were you making, by the way?
After 2 weeks, I got my paycheck, and it was $600.
So yeah. You get the job. How do you get the call? How are you called up from the minor leagues of the mailroom into the assistant?
Well, first of all, I had a good attitude. You see so quickly in the mailroom who's going to, it's a sink or swim, and you see so quickly who's going to swim. There are people who will, you know, become disillusioned within a week, you know. There are people who leave the first week. It's like, what the f*** am I doing pushing a mail cart? I have an MBA from Harvard. What the f***, you know, or someone who's been an attorney, and you see, I mean, I saw, you know, one of my friends broke down, was pushing the mail cart, just broke, symbolically, the mail cart, like, spontaneously disassembled in the middle of the hallway, and he just broke down and started crying, and, I mean, he didn't leave that day, but we all knew that he wasn't going to last. So what happened for me, well, just to answer your question, was I was walking down the hallway one day, and some assistant, you know, stopped me, and he said, are you Shai? And I said, yes. And he's like, my friend told me that you were a stand-up comedian. And I said, I am. So we went out for lunch, and we hit it off. And this guy, Scott, happened to work for David Lawner.
Who's one of the major talent agents at William Morris, is a motion picture agent.
Not just major. I mean, at the time, he was co-running the motion picture department. So Scott had me sit down with David, and David hired me as an AMPM. At William Morris, they have this thing called an AMPM, which is trainees get the luxury of, before you start in the mailroom at 9:30, you get in at like 8 o'clock or 7:30, 8 o'clock. And then after the mailroom closes at 6:30 p.m., you go back to that person, you work till close. So you sort of start getting a sense of how the actual desk job works. So I was working as the AMPM for David, helping the assistant to David and sort of learning the way David worked, learning his clients, you know, just sort of starting to develop relationships with the client's assistants, you know. And then, you know, Scott.
So you may not be a mogul, you may not be even an assistant to a mogul, but you're the assistant to the assistant of a mogul.
Yes. It obviously helped that I was had a very good relationship with, because sometimes it's not that rosy. I mean, sometimes if you don't get along with the assistant, then it's ugly, because not only are you, you know, constantly next to someone you don't like, but that person is often your age, if not younger, and giving you orders, which can be very difficult to swallow. But me and Scott became, he's one of my closest friends, he's a manager now, he left William Morris, but, you know, he's the one who got me the gig, and when his year was up, or I think it was actually a year and a half, David needed a new assistant. And I had already sort of, I guess demonstrated that I knew what I was doing. And
I wanted to seize on something you said, which is his year was up. It sounds like there are increments to this process. Is that how it works? Like after a year, it's time to sort of...
The norm is 1 year, and then you either, if your goal was just to start an agency and then move on to a studio or production company, then presumably if you did a good job, your boss will help you get a job outside the company. If your goal is to get promoted within the company, you know, within the agency, you'll go to another desk. But there's variety. I mean, some agents like to keep their assistants for longer.
Josh Shai Steinberger had been an assistant at William Morris for more than 2 years when he quit last month to pursue his career as a writer and a comedian. His goodbye email to the William Morris staff has had tongues wagging all over Hollywood. What's true about working at a talent agency, and what would surprise us?
What's true? I think it's true that it's the best place to learn about the business. You get to work with everybody. The agency works in every field of entertainment. So you're working on, you could learn about movies, you could learn about television, you could learn about music, you could learn about, I mean, William Morris has an enormous consulting, you know, arm that deals with companies as prestigious as General Motors and Starbucks. So I think that's something that people hear and I think is very much true. You make all the relationships, you meet a million people, because, you know, like just in the Beverly Hills office, I think William Morris is like 550 employees. And on top of that, I think most people who, you know, come to L.A. to pursue a dream are from, you know, from all over the country, and you don't necessarily have a lot of friends. And it's a good way to just build a social network for yourself.
What surprised you? Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I researched what I was getting myself into pretty thoroughly before I moved out there. I read a lot of literature on Hollywood, and I don't think anything surprised me. Obviously, the way I was treated surprised me, even though I had read about stuff. I didn't know what it actually felt like to be treated that way, so I guess that was a little surprising.
The public perception of an agent is largely driven by this sort of Ari Gold entourage, you know, sort of sleazy hyena who is amoral and kind of conniving and, you know, willing to push his mother off a building for a bottle cap, but also smart and funny. And I'm just wondering, like, how that jibes with what you found.
Listen, there are some who are conniving, and there are some who will stab you in the back. But I would say there's nobody. They're definitely not that funny and charismatic. Otherwise, they would all be, you know, on the performing side of the business, not on behind the camera. You know, most agents, and especially I was fortunate, at least at William Morris, I worked for incredibly good-hearted people. One of the things I liked about both David and Jeff is that they were both family guys. They were very down-to-earth and would never pull that kind of. They certainly were not amoral. I mean, they both put like families first and business second. They were fantastic role models for me, and that's why, you know, what you said earlier in the conversation about the email, it was genuinely good-hearted, even though it was obviously supposed to be funny. There are agents like that. I mean, and, you know, working for David, I obviously got to listen on calls with Ari Emanuel, who I guess the Ari Gold character is based on. He's actually that funny. I mean, he's hilarious. In fact, one time on the phone, Ari said something which I found to be so hilarious that I was hysterical laughing, and I was muted. The assistants are always allowed to listen on the phones, but on mute. But I was laughing so loudly that Ari Emanuel heard me through the phone, even though I was on mute. And he goes, "What the f*** was that?" He's like, "David, teach your f***ing assistant how to use the mute button." And that only made me laugh harder.
Do you remember what he said?
It was when the Directors Guild Awards were announced, and Ari was calling David back. We had left word for him. Ari called back and said, "Yeah." So David said, "You know, congratulations." So Ari's like, "About what?" So David's like, "Come on, you know." And Ari's like, "No, I just got off a plane. Like, what did we get?" So he's like, "Well, the DJ nominees were just announced." So Ari's like, "Oh, what did we get?" He's like, "You got Scorsese for The Departed, and you got Iñárritu for Babel." So Ari goes, "Oh, nice." He's like, "What'd you guys get?" So David's like, "We got one." He's like, Ari's like, "Which one?" He's like, "Dreamgirls." So Ari's like, "Oh, that movie's a piece of." And I was just hysterical. I just thought that was so funny that he just sort of laid it on. You just be very honest, you know what I mean?
Actually, I want to pick up on something you said. The fact that you were on that call and the reason why, I think a lot of people don't realize that assistants are on every call. Talk a little bit about why that is and what you learned.
I mean, unless the agent specifically tells you you're not allowed to be on the call, you're allowed to be on every call, and that's how you learn the business. You know, it's sort of... It's like old-fashioned, you know, like it's an apprenticeship, you know, like in the old days when you'd work for, you know, some craftsman, you know, some woodsmith, and you'd learn how to do. You learn the way they do business. You watch the way they interact with the different people, with the studio heads, with the producers, with the attorneys, the managers. You learn everything. I mean, unless unless my bosses specifically told me to get off the line, I was on every single phone call, and that's how you learn what they're doing all day.
And you can't really zone out on these calls either, because you're not just sitting there absorbing, right? They'll ask you to do something, or they'll ask you a question, and you're sort of part of the conversation and not, right?
I think how much you're part of the conversation will depend on the specific agent. I think with both David and Jeff, for example, I think I had developed enough of a good relationship where they would actually reference me on phone calls and say, "Shai, you getting this?" Or like, "Shai, you in?" Or they'd ask me, "Shai, what did that person say?" You know, and they'd actually have me get on, unmute myself, and contribute. Most of the time, though, you have to be taking notes, especially because agents will often be rolling calls from their car, and they can't take down. So if like they're negotiating a deal and they want to write down the numbers, you better be on there, you know, scribbling it down, because they're going to ask you for it when they get back to the office.
Now, for people who have not worked in talent agencies, what rolling calls is a sort of unique thing unto itself. Explain what rolling calls is.
Rolling calls is, I guess, just a different way that Hollywood says making calls. But I think in Hollywood, the entire business is done on the phone. So literally, you are on the phone without break from 8 a.m. till 8 p.m., you know. So rolling calls is just, I think, an expression that connotes sort of the continuity of it and the sort of rapid fire, boom, 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 boom. You're just rolling down this phone sheet.
Because the sense I had was that there was a certain time of day when everybody gets called back. There's sort of you roll a bunch of calls in the morning and you roll again at the end of the day. Because my understanding is, just talking to assistants, you know, I would call an agent sometimes and say, "Oh, you know, I was calling for so-and-so. Is he available?" And you would get this instantaneous, almost automatronic kind of response, which was, you know, "I can't right now. We're rolling. We'll call you in a moment. Bye."
Don't take this the wrong way, Claude. If Harvey Weinstein calls in, I think you have to get up and go in there and make sure, even if your boss is in a meeting, you know, you'd probably want to see if they're willing to take the call. I mean, if someone high-level enough, you always check. You know, I think there's an implicit hierarchy. That's one of the things you learn when you're an assistant.
Are you suggesting that when I call, people don't flinch like frightened collies?
Listen, Claude, I'm just saying there's a difference between you and Harvey Weinstein, that's all.
Yeah.
I think that's probably a good thing for you.
We need to probably wrap this up, so I want to just get to the point of what's going to happen with you now, and also back to the email for a second. One of the reasons I think the email was so talked about was that very, very few people, once they've gone through the sort of trial by fire that you've described of being a William Morris agency assistant, ever leave, because they've invested so much, because it usually leads to becoming an agent there, or because they're afraid to break the code of omerta, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
What are you leaving to do, and how will your time at William Morris help you do it?
Well, I'm not leaving to become a tattoo artist, like it said in my email. I'm leaving to go back into writing and stand-up comedy. I mean, I have three projects going on right now. I have to say, I owe Nikki Fink and Gina Piccolo, the woman at the LA Times who wrote about me, because after those things were posted, not only did I get applause from like the assistant community of Hollywood, but I got an agent, I got a publicist.
I have to ask, you have an agent where?
not at CA or William Morris. My agent's in New York. Because of what happened with the media, I don't know that William Morris was particularly happy that it was as widely circulated as it was. And I actually emailed a close friend of mine at William Morris who was pretty high up at the company, and I said, "You know, what's your sense? Is this like a sore spot now for William Morris because this email became so public?" And he's like, "Yeah, no, my sense is probably not." So I'm like, "All right."
Well, Shai Steinberger, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. I'm glad you survived the slings and arrows of William Morris and CAA. Keep us updated and come back anytime.
Yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure, Claude. Thanks for having me.
After a short break, writing yourself out of the credits. You're listening to The Business from NPR. Everybody comes to Last week, we heard from producer and Oscar-winning writer Akiva Goldsman about how writers often have to fight to get credit for their work. This week, we turn that idea on its head with a writer who fought to get his name off a film. Novelist Trey Ellis was thrilled when Disney bought the rights and asked him to direct his story of a middle-class family summering in a ritzy black enclave on Martha's Vineyard in the 1970s. But another director ended up taking the helm, and the movie turned into something that Trey didn't much care for. Trey Ellis, welcome to the business.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about The Inkwell and your time as the screenwriter for that film at Disney.
When they decided they didn't want me to direct, we had talked to some other directors who would have been more appropriate, and then things just didn't work out. And then they decided upon Matty Rich, who had done a film called Straight Out of Brooklyn. And I, at the time, of course, I said, that's a curious choice, because I'm writing about a black middle-class kid who ends up in this very upper-class world, black upper-class world, and this is something that Matty Rich, coming from Red Hook, Brooklyn, knew nothing about. But they said, well, he's got heart and he's got heat, so they were convinced that he was the right person for the job. I was skeptical, but I, you know, wanted to give him a chance. And then when I read the script that he had commissioned, because he had had it completely rewritten, from everything was just completely changed, so it really broke my heart. And I just couldn't keep my name on this film, even though it would be my first produced film.
Take me in that meeting for just a moment, and I mean, what's your reaction when they say, well, we want to go in a different direction, maybe Matty Rich? I mean, it just seems like, did people say, like, well, where are the afros and bell-bottoms, and why aren't people smoking weed in the bathroom?
There was, you know, it had been a long, drawn-out process, and they assured me, they said, well, even though it's not an obvious choice because of his previous film, which is a really kind of very crude cinema verite film. They assured me that he had this great passion and this vision for this project. And I met with him, and he just said, oh, I remember he was saying, I'm in the car with a star. Just everybody is just, oh, we love you. You're a genius, Trey, and don't worry, it's going to be fantastic. We know what we're doing. We've made a lot of movies. Trust us. I paid the price for that.
So to be clear, you, for you, it was strictly an aesthetic one. It had nothing to do with your brand, so to speak, as a black novelist. That this would jeopardize sort of your bread and butter, which is writing, you know, books about the black experience in America in the 20th and 21st century.
Well, I'm very vain, and I like my good name. I love being recognized. I love people asking for my autograph or my signing a book. It's just I think that's great. And when I get to people, when I'm on the Vineyard now, and I talk to people and say, yeah, I wrote that movie, The Inkwell. Like, I just, you know, still to this day, they're like, oh, you wrote that thing. And I got to say, but I took my name off, and it's not really me. So I try to have it both ways. I'd rather just do work that I'm really proud of. And I think any artist, all you have is you have your name and your legacy. You know, you have what your kids are going to know about you and your grandkids. And it just wasn't worth it to me.
Mm-hmm. What did your agent say to you?
He said, okay, you can change, you know, they paid you less than $200,000, so you can change your name. My first choice for a name was Ahmad Blackman. And he said, look, if you do that, you'll never work again. That's like just, you don't want to say, like, sort of screw you to the studio. You've got to be more clever about your pseudonym. So that's when, since I speak Italian, and his name was Matty Rich, I just invented this name, Tom Rico Stronzo, which is an acronym sort of for Matty Rich is an Uncle Tom. And I was, you know, I took some childish glee in that act. I still guess I get a little bit of a chuckle out of it.
By the way, Rico Stronzo, is that an Italian word for something?
Rico is rich, and Stronzo with an O at the end means like a turd.
Now, I want to jump back for 1 second here. You mentioned that the reason you were able to take your name off of this has something to do with some sort of arcane Writers Guild rule. Explain that briefly, if you would.
Well, the rule makes, I mean, you can imagine it makes sense. If you are a super high-paid screenwriter and they want to bill the movie as being written by you, and they paid you a certain amount of money, in this case of the Guild, it was $200,000, then they have the right to you keeping your name on your work. If you're going to take the money, then you have to keep your name on the work. But there is this clause, if they pay you less than $200,000, then you have the choice of taking your name off, because they figure they're not really going to sell it as like a movie by Trey Ellis.
So your Pride gets sold at $201,000, basically.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. So you'd think somebody speaks Italian at Disney. What was their reaction to that choice of name on the script?
I didn't hear a word from them. I worked for them. I did other movies for them. I've done other movies for them since then, and it has not adversely affected my career. But what I thought was so amazing is the day before the wedding of the president of the studio at that time, we were at this restaurant, Patrick's Roadhouse, which is like a famous kind of Hollywood hangout on Pacific Coast Highway. And he came up to me and he said, "I'm sorry for what we did to your film." And I just thought, the day before this guy was getting married, I thought that just really healed all the any kind of rancor I could have felt for that. I just thought it was a really stand-up thing to say. He didn't have to say it, and he didn't have to even feel it, but he felt it, and it just felt like I wasn't just alone. It wasn't just me thinking I'd done some good work. They could have turned into a really classic, wonderful film.
You said that there was no big fallout, but I mean, was your agent in a fetal ball? Were you
he was
holed
really
up in a hotel drinking yourself stupid, or like what are those weeks and months after that like?
Well, it was the kind of thing where I was sure, looking at the script, I said no good can come out of this, so I took my name off. You certainly have some second guessing, and you think there have been plenty of really, really awful movies that do really, really well and launch people's careers. And it's the movie could have been a hit, even though it's terrible. And before it came out, I was really thinking, oh, man, if this is a giant hit, I'll look really dumb for having taken my name off. And that would probably hurt my career. There would be a more public sort of slap in the face to Hollywood. But luckily for me, I called it right, and the movie just sank like a stone, and nobody saw it. So, so people decided, like, I bet on the right horse. I won that bet.
Looking back now, with the benefit of hindsight and experience and from other projects under your belt in Hollywood, do you think you were naive about the process by which movies get made?
Oh, certainly so. I mean, when I look back at the lesson I've learned is that, when you have that heat and everyone's saying that you're terrific, it's easy to think, if you think that you're terrific anyway and people are just really reflecting how you feel about yourself, you assume that's going to last forever. And so when I gave up that child, put it on the doorstep, or they just ripped it from my arms and gave it to Matty Rich to suffocate, I thought, well, I'll write other ones. I've written other scripts which I like just as much. But the world of Hollywood is so ephemeral. And you just, really, the stars have to align the exact right way for a film to get made. And I didn't realize, because it happened so quickly and so early in my career and so easily, how difficult it can be to make those stars align again. So certainly if I had to do it again, I wouldn't have taken the money for selling a spec script to Touchstone. I would have taken it back and independently showed my, raised some money independently and directed my own movie and had a whole different take on it.
Trey Ellis is a novelist, essayist, and screenwriter living in New York. He teaches screenwriting at Columbia University. And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts covering politics, news, music, arts, and culture. For more details, visit kcrw.com.